Hello and welcome to our podcast series, Conversations with Kids Peace. I'm Bob Martin. Mental and behavioral healthcare operations, like most parts of what we call the caring professions, have been struggling lately with attracting and retaining qualified workers for jobs that are both difficult and historically underfunded. Jennifer Udvardi Morris is a program manager at our Foster Care and Community Programs office in Kingston, New York. She's been lobbying legislators in that state to address the issue, which she says can be affecting the quality of care provided to the vulnerable kids there. She joined us to talk about the issue and her efforts to find a solution. Here's our conversation. Jennifer, thanks for joining us today on the podcast. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Let's start off with just talking about what your current job is at Kids Peace, and how long have you been in the child welfare field?
So I'm currently the program manager of the foster care program in our Kingston, New York FCCP office. I've actually been working in child welfare for over 20 years at this point, basically since I graduated from college back in 2002. But I've been with Kids Peace continuously for 17 years. I worked for Kids Peace right after college. I moved away and then I came back to Kids Peace in 2007. So I started as a family consultant, so our caseworker position, working with children and families. And then I worked and moved into other supervisory positions like senior family consultant and then assistant program manager. I've been program manager since early 2020. So I've really had the opportunity to work directly with kids and families doing case management and getting to know that position before coming into, you know, more of a supervisory and managerial role.
Oh, well, it's great. We're so lucky to have folks like you on our staff. Really appreciate your dedication. Now, we've talked in the past about how New York, the programs in New York, have been able to extend our associates' expertise and their connection with kids in foster care in ensuring their well-being in other areas. To me, it seems like the state is very innovative when it comes to this stuff. Is that how you see it?
So, yeah, definitely. And I mean, I pat us on the back, too, to say I think that Kids Peace programs in particular have been innovative and creative with how they're utilizing that programming. Health homes, CFTSS, which is Child and Family Treatment Supports and Services, and then most recently 29i, which is the medical arm of foster care within New York. I think at Kids Peace, and this is attributed to how the state rolled it out, the Kids Peace has been able to take a collaborative approach amongst programs, with the programs working together with the kids in our foster care program to have a cohesive treatment team where each program has different and clear roles, but that they support and complement each other. And I think the state allowed for agencies and organizations to have some leeway and creativity with how they implemented the programs, which allowed us to run the programs in the way that we are. I think ultimately the state realized that a community-based service model was really able to meet kids and families where they were at, and that providing programs that could be flexible and creative with services that fit with the needs of individual families, it kind of just had the ability to be more successful and reach more families than previous models, maybe a clinic-based model. And I think we've seen, at least in our office, that families, both those with kids in foster care, kids who have maybe been discharged from foster care, or those kids who are remaining at home but are at risk, they've been more receptive as a result. All of that said, with, you know, as innovative and supportive as the programs can be, they do rely on us being able to adequately support and train, you know, staffing and maintain that staffing.
And that goes to my next question, of course. I just wanted to find out what prompted you to, take on the task of lobbying the state and the legislators for better treatment for the child welfare professionals?
So like I mentioned, I've been working in child welfare for over 20 years. And even though it's generally been direct work, I've had some opportunities to work in public policy, but I've always also been interested in public policy initiatives that affect children engaged in the child welfare system. And it was actually one of the motivating factors behind getting my master's of public health, that this combination of program planning and public health policy initiatives that can work in partnership together. But it's really been the last few years, and I would say, you know, since the pandemic, that I've taken an acute interest in how the way we care for our workforce really affects the way in which we're able to care for the kids and families we're trying to serve. It's a hard job, and it doesn't end at the end of the day. Our staff really carry it home with them, and it's just not the kind of job that just turns off at the end of the day. You know, and as a result, as a system, we talk a lot about trauma-informed care in terms of the services we provide to our clients, right? But we kind of forget about the idea of trauma-informed support for our workers and the very people tasked with doing the work. In New York, and I don't think it's isolated to New York, but I can really only speak to New York specifically, there's been a lot of turnover in the last few years combined with the hiring crisis across agencies. This is not a Kidspeace specific problem. But it's led to agencies like Kidspeace being hamstrung in terms of being able to meet the need for children placed in foster care. We're just not doing enough to support our workforce. And it's really risking the quality of care we're able to give the kids. So I started to think about, how do we rephrase it? How do we present this to decision makers, essentially policymakers at the government level, to see this as a system investment and a human issue rather than just a budgetary issue? Because I think it's really easy to simplify and dismiss the issue of wage increase as just people wanting more money. And I think, unfortunately, that's what a lot of legislators have seen it as in the past. But when you remind them of the human cost of not investing in this system and what happens when we don't do that, people's ears open. And the best people to lobby, advocate, and motivate legislators, in my opinion at least, are really the people who've been doing the work, the kind of boots on the ground, so to speak. And so that's just a natural progression for me to do what I have been doing and then sort of work into this kind of taking on this kind of activity as well.
You mentioned the impact on the quality of care. And as part of your efforts, you wrote a guest column for the Times Union newspaper in Albany, New York, which is, of course, the capital. And you mentioned how turnover in staff can have a direct impact on the quality of care. I wonder if you can kind of connect the dots for us the way you did in that article.
Yeah, of course. Data is important, and data helps people connect things. You know, in 2022, for instance, the turnover rate in New York among frontline foster care staff is 49%. So effectively, that's half of our workforce that we've turned over. A lot of those people aren't just leaving one agency to go to another. They're leaving entirely. So you combine that with difficulty hiring, and it leaves vacancies within many agencies across the state. So you can't manage referrals, you can't move forward with admissions, or I guess you can, and then you overload the staff you already have, the staff who is remaining. So you have these difficult choices. So then admissions stagnate, or the caseloads become too high, but the needs stay the same. And so you can't possibly meet the need of every kid if this is how you're managing. You know, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt you there.
So you just need quality staff from the start, with recruiting and training families to placement and case management. So every agency that I've interacted with is struggling to keep up with the number of referrals, and that includes, you know, residential, and we're just not meeting that need. So I think you could say it affects admissions. We can't place kids in care, or they're having to be placed in inappropriate levels of care. But it's also affecting permanency too, and that ability for us to achieve permanency for our kids. So there's research that has shown that every time a caseworker turns over, permanency is delayed by an average of 6 months. So we say that, but it doesn't exist on its own. You know, that's not a one-time thing. Kids aren't just having one turnover often. We've worked with kids in care who have been in care for several years and have experienced 5 or 6 caseworkers. So we're talking years of delayed permanency, not just 6 months. I was recently reading a study, it was done a handful of years ago out of Wisconsin, actually, that showed that when children have one caseworker over the life of their case, if permanency is achieved 75% of the time. But if there's just one instance of turnover, would you believe that number drops to 34%?
Wow.
So like, that's staggering.
That is, you're right. I mean, that's just incredible.
Now, and then it keeps dropping.
Right, exactly. Because as you say, it's not just one turnover, it's several. Mm-hmm. And of course, turnover a lot of times is related to burnout. And in your article, again, you make the point that there's a direct line between inadequate pay and benefits and the occasion of burnout among staff members. Mm-hmm. In a way that I hadn't really thought of before. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. It's something I'm feeling really passionate about, you know. This job is tough. We all know it's tough, right? Nobody goes into this job thinking that they'll be rich. And they go into this job out of a desire to do good and make a difference. But like I said, you know, this job doesn't go away at night. You know, people, they bring it home with them and they turn it over in their heads and they're trying to still think of solutions. Excuse me. But a lot of workers in our field don't get to just go home at night. A lot of them have second or third jobs just to make ends meet. And so they end their day doing casework and then they go right to their second job and sometimes the third job. And what this does is it eliminates the downtime that's needed to process feelings and experiences of what we would consider vicarious trauma that they're having to manage, and they're not able to engage in self-care. They don't have that time to take care of themselves because they're working hard to make ends meet. And so what happens is that stress and that emotional exhaustion, that experience of vicarious trauma, it builds up over time. And then you have burnout. And then you have people who just, I can't do this anymore. And I was speaking to a New York legislator just a couple months ago, and he asked about trainings. And I said, you know, the system, you know, our state training process for caseworkers, I said, it doesn't do a great job of preparing workers for the things that they'll experience as part of the job. We teach them how to do their job, but we don't teach them how to manage the stress. We don't teach them how to be aware when they're starting to experience trauma themselves. And I think there needs a space and and a need for providing trauma-informed supports and trainings for staff so that it's not just about how to do their jobs, but it's also about how to manage their jobs. So it's twofold. The salary issue is huge, and it affects people's ability to engage in those skills that we need them to be able to stay. In some areas of New York right now, foster care workers are only making around $5,000 more than minimum wage. And so when you think of the emotional difficulties of the job, if the system isn't going to support the workforce that it has, a lot of these people think, I can make just as much or take a little bit of a pay cut for a job, but for a job that doesn't come home with me. You know, and that's how we're losing people.
And you know, it just occurred to me that it's sort of ironic because obviously a lot of the training that these folks are getting are about how to help kids and families manage the stress of the day, the trauma that they're dealing, and to turn and say, well, we don't do enough for the people. We don't do enough training and support for the trainers and the supporters of these folks. It's sort of, it's an interesting, ironic twist, I think. Now, yeah. In 2023, you note in your article that the state did increase pay and benefits payments, not to the extent that you and others thought they should get to. What do you see as the outlook for them further addressing this in 2024?
So I'm actually kind of optimistic. So, you know, last year, organizations like Kids Peace partnered with our New York-based advocacy group, Council on family and child care and agencies, we refer to as CAFCA. They advocated for an 8.5% cost of living adjustment. That got passed at 4%, which fell really just far below the level of investment and support the system needs, especially when you consider that it really feels like the system's on the brink right now. But just last week, so it's interesting that we're meeting today, it's just last Tuesday, our Lower New York Regional Manager, Samantha Higgins, and I attended the CAFCA lobbying day in Albany to support, you know, further increases like we did last year. So the governor's budget this year was advocating for a 1.5% cost of living adjustment. And so CAFCA is really advocating for a 3.2 increase, which would push it closer to that 8.5% from last year. Another issue that's really come up, and it links to that, is that the wage disparity between voluntary agency workers like Kids Peace and public agency-based county or city casework staff. There's the average salary is separated by about $16,000. So there's a lot of talk among CAFCA and legislators who are supporting the workforce to address that wage disparity and have and work towards parity between the work. And you can take that into account that agencies like Kids Peace handle 80% of the foster care placements in New York, to doing so much of the work, but at a significantly lower rate. So that's an issue as well. But what I wanted to get back to was that when we attended last year, we kind of felt like this was an unknown. You know, the legislators didn't really know what we were talking about. When we went last week, there was a lot more awareness. There was a lot more openness, a lot of questions, a lot of times hearing, your job is so tough, we could never do what you do, but we shouldn't be saying that without giving you the support that you need. And being able to see this is not a salary issue, but a human issue. So we got some really good feedback. I feel optimistic that while we might not get to the 3.2, we will get higher than the 1.5. And just it's just important, and when we're advocating for these increases, that we're able to remind decision makers that their decisions trickle down to the children and families that rely on this system. And we're not just talking about increasing someone's salary. We're really talking about giving workers the means to take care of themselves and their families in a way that allows them to stay in the job. And that's what the children and families are counting on. They're counting on us being able to support a system that supports them. So I feel optimistic that members of the legislature in New York have their ears open. They want to learn and they want to support.
And obviously, that's one of the key building blocks. Doesn't mean the journey's over, but it means that you've at least made that point of that they understand the problem and hopefully will be willing to work with you for solutions. Well, Jennifer, every guest we have on the podcast, we ask them for a life hack. This could be your favorite saying, something that gets you motivated in the morning. Maybe it could be just how to do something around the house a little better, whatever. But what's your life hack for us today?
So I thought about this and I realized that I do this anyway. So it's do everything with music. You know, clean your house, exercise, go on a drive to clear your head, catch up on paperwork, connect with your kids. Just whatever it is, it feels easier and more fun with music, you know, and it's something that everybody can connect to and with others. So do everything with music. That's my life hack and my advice.
And I would add, as someone with literally, like, clinically no musical skills at all, you still can enjoy it and you still can get fun singing. You might just have to wait till you're alone in the car to do that, but that's neither here. Jennifer, thank you so much not only for being with us, but for everything you're doing for the kids in New York. And we look forward to having you come back and talk about some of the successes as we get through the year here.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
We want to thank Jennifer Udvardi Morris, the program manager at Kids Peace's Foster Care Community Programs Operation in Kingston, New York, for joining us on the podcast. Her guest column on the destructive aspects of staff turnover in child welfare in the state of New York ran in the Albany Times Union in December. It can be found on our blog at fostercare.com. Thank you for joining us as well. We look forward to having you join us again for more Conversations with Kids Peace. Until then, take care.